This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Indiana U.S. Senator Mike Braun. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Hoosier Senator Mike Braun next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 490 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. After just 4 years in the upper chamber, Senator Mike Braun is recently recognized as one of the most effective leaders on Capitol Hill. The Hoosier senator has proven he's not afraid to reach across the aisle on challenging issues. He's been in the fray on top issues including climate, renewable fuels, and the Biden administration's Waters of the U.S. regulations. Braun says the debt ceiling debate has implications for the farm bill.
Well, it is important, and it's mostly in the mid and long term. And now that mid and long term is starting to get frightening because of what we've been doing basically since 2000. $5 trillion in debt when we started the Gulf Wars. Added five in Bush's 8 years, to took us to 10. Obama added $6 trillion from 08 to 16. That's 2 years before I got there. Now we're spending $1 trillion more than what we take in. Add two more years, that's 18. And now we are at $31 trillion. Biden and the CBO just put two budgets out there that put us $51 trillion in debt. I asked a bunch of reporters, what is 1% of $30 trillion? They couldn't get that number out. It's got so many zeros. Of course, that's $300 billion. Interest rates have gone up 4%. All that math comes back. It always wins. That's why finance is so important. I'm glad Kevin McCarthy and the House are making a stand, because if not, the numbers will win in the long run, and it'll be painful if we don't start addressing it. This money is given to us by taxpayers. Just spend less than you take in. And we've not been on that format for way over two decades, and it's both Republicans and Democrats that have been part of the problem.
At the AgriPulse Summit that took place on March 20 in Washington, we had leaders that were talking about the price of the new farm bill up over 60% compared to the 18, could be approaching $1.5 trillion. Senator, you catch that situation where your back's against the wall of things that you want to do and the things that you have to do. And the farm bill looks to be a classic example of this.
Of what you want to do, and it's going into, like, we've done this, let's even dig the hole deeper. If you take that 60% increase, and that's done every 5 years, but it's over a 10-year horizon, that's roughly 6% increases, and the economy only grows in a good year 2 to 3%. So that's the political enterprising that the current Democrats are going for broke, and I think we will go broke as a country. And then the other thing that makes it, in my mind, an unholy alliance is you got to get on these bills 10 Republicans to go along. We're the party of fiscal conservatism, so to speak. But it's the defense neocons, the real extreme hawks, that team up with every Democrat that give us an unholy alliance of borrowing from our kids and grandkids. And we've got to confront it at some point. This idea of the government shutting down, we'd always pay our interest and our principal. That's the only thing legally we're supposed to do. And sooner or later, we're going to have to start, since we don't do budgeting, find out what we're going to do less of. Otherwise, it starts to devalue the currency. You cannot be a nation of spenders and borrowers. Our greatest generation paid off the biggest debt we ever had after World War II and built the interstate highway system without borrowing money.
So the chairwoman of the Senate Ag Committee has said she's not going to vote for a farm bill if it includes cuts to nutrition or if there are dollars taken away from conservation programs that was secured in the 117th. And then ranking member Bozeman this week told Spencer Chase with AgriPulse he's not going to vote for a farm bill if it doesn't address reference prices to make those more palatable to the economy that farmers are operating in today.
Exactly, and I hear that all the time. So, reference prices.
And then on the other side, we have both the chair and also the ranking member in the House have talked about what they won't vote for. So the question is, what can we vote for, and ultimately, what can we afford?
So we can't afford anything, even when it's things we like farm policy. I generally have tried to hold firm that if it doesn't have an honest pay for, if it's not within reason, I'll even vote against something that I really like on the policy. Here it begs the question. We still call it the farm bill. For anybody out there paying attention, that's only right under 10% of the bill that directly impacts farmers. Conservation's 4-5%. So you hit it on the head. 85% of this bill is nutrition. And it has dominated it. So look at all those increases you were talking about. That's mostly going into nutrition. And we'd be borrowing the money to support that. So I'm going to have a lot of trouble with it. I do think, though, we'll carve out something on the farm bill itself, because it is the least partisan of any navigation we take. And I'm still optimistic that some of that might be bravado, and maybe we'll actually rein it in a bit, because we know, even though it's going into a farm bill, it's mostly nutrition, and we at least ought to have the 10% that directly impacts farmers to where we get something in terms of what would make it make sense, given the high commodity prices along with the high input costs.
Boy, if you want a polar issue, talk about work requirements for SNAP or anything that would include taking dollars away from nutrition programs, which certainly are needed. There's no question that there's need, but we're talking about $1.2 trillion of a 23 farm bill.
Yeah, so I'm going to be one that across the board on any of our social welfare programs, if you are able-bodied, you need to work. And if you're not working, I think that is what worries me about the system we've currently got. It's taking the work ethic that was built in post-World War II. You look at what happened during COVID when we incentivized people to stay home and watch Netflix. The federal government can't be the business partner of either businesses or labor, especially when you're borrowing money to pay for what you're supposed to be doing, and now it's gotten to a really to where it's so out of hand. So work requirements, that would have never even been an issue years ago. And if we do not require that, we're just openly creating a welfare state that will break us even further and more quickly.
So I know that you don't drive the train in the Senate and you don't even get to ring the bell, but it's a question that I think some of your constituents would ask. Can we get a farm bill? And if so, what would you expect us to win?
So I think we can get a farm bill. I think if we don't, even for the enterprisers that want to spend 6-10% more each year in government on everything, they will have a lot on the line in terms of it's important, happens every 5 years, it's generally the least partisan thing we do, and I think it will be egg on their face. And all of those statements you said in terms of what people want to do, you know that most of it's being spent on nutrition, and I think that's the part, if we're going to have budget in mind, that's got to give when you're carved down to just 5% on conservation, 10% on helping farmers directly. So I think there'll be a proclivity to actually get something done, swallow your pride a little bit, and at least show that we can do the one thing that's supposed to be simplest to get it across the finish line. That's why I'm optimistic that will happen.
I'd love to say my list of questions has an easy one in there somewhere, but I don't see any gimmies along the line. And just before we had the opportunity to go into discussion, I saw legislation that you are working with Senator Grassley and Senator Ernst to finally put a definition on what is a water of the U.S. Legislation meets regulation.
That has probably been the most weaponized part of the current government, would be the EPA. And Waters of the U.S. Has been back and forth in terms of a new ruling since the Obama years. If you recall, we had that to a more practical place here right at the end of the Trump administration. Well, when the new regime took over, that was the first thing that they said they're not going to implement, and they've taken it back the other way. So this bill, sadly, will not get six Democrats to vote for it. So we'll message around it, and it would be to take that rule where farmers and small developers and everyone else that wants it to be reasonable, we want to take care of Mother Earth, we want clean water, but we don't want conservation officers running farmers down on their back 40 when they're maintaining a ditch that normally has no water in it, but still has to be maintained. That's kind of where this has gone. When we were building 69 back during the time when it was flipping the other way, and you saw all those signs on the bank of a road, I don't know how much each sign cost, but it was probably over $100 or two to make it and install it. Waters of the U.S. I mean, that is government in overdrive. And sadly, unless I think we get control to where we control the presidency, and then maybe even not when it comes to trying to legislate it, we'd have to flip the rule again. That's got unpredictability to it. Farmers are getting whipsawed all different directions, as well as developers, too. So that is something that, sadly, we may be in the realm of rules, because I don't ever see getting 10 Democrats to come along with a more reasonable WOTUS.
We could spend the rest of the day and part of tomorrow talking about what to do with China, especially as the military front and their threat continues to grow. But if we're looking from the agriculture sector, they have purchased a number of global agriculture industries, and some of those predominant in the U.S. But you're a part of a group that is standing out and questioning now Chinese and others in the globe and their ownership of U.S. farmland. Why is this coming to a head now, and why is it important to take action here?
So I'm actually a lead sponsor on that bill, and it would include anyone that's associated with the Chinese, the Russian government, the Iranian government, or the North Korean government. And it's mostly on the basis of the 800-pound gorilla in that discussion, that's China. They had the ability to liberalize their political system along with what they did with their economic system. They could clearly see communism wasn't going to work there. They became state capitalists. And then instead of being a handshake business partner, from currency manipulations to intellectual property to almost any measurement, it's not been like that. Commitments on climate. They're still producing coal-fired plants weekly. A lot of just stuff that does not add up. And then when they're buying farmland, maybe close to a military installation, I don't think that makes sense. So I think that relationship is totally a function of what they want to do, controlling their own behavior. Taiwan, are they going to go in after them? Are they going to try to commandeer the Southeast Asia area? I think we got to be careful, and I think for them, the relationships through their road and belt plan in South America and Africa, they're trying to build an economy, a relationship with the developing countries, and I think they drop us like a bad penny, EU and us, when we still might be dependent on some of those supply chain maneuvers that were made over the last few decades, where it's very tricky, very complicated, and then farmers get caught in the crossfire.
So in the same respect, in dealing with our dependence on China, there is a push by the administration to get us to electric vehicles. And in order to have an electric vehicle, you need a strong battery. And many of those parts, many of those elements that are a part of the energy supply system for those vehicles comes from China.
They've got that market cornered. Ironically, we've got a lot of that in our western states that currently are off limits due to EPA and environmental guidelines. And if we want to have people driving electric vehicles, even to get to first base, we've got to acknowledge that the grid will have to expand to handle it. And we do not want to be at the mercy of those rare earth minerals, what they're called, to where we have to get it from some foreign country. And they have been very, very hardworking at trying to corner those markets wherever they are. And they now would be the lead place to get the rare earth minerals or that battery technology, or if you're going to sub out the production. That's another kind of disjointed part of where some of these climate policies are trying to lead us, when it's not going to be consistent with what we can do politically. And even when you look at issues like not only economic security, but the military component of it as well. So it's got a lot of complications to it that I don't know how that works out. We just better be vigilant.
I wonder where rural Indiana and rural America would be had we not stepped into the ethanol fray years ago, now to 5 billion bushels of demand for an industry that still has room to grow. How do you feel about the EPA's handling of the RFS, and what's our future with next generation biofuels and sustainable aviation fuel as opportunity for renewable fuels?
It's a great opportunity, and I ironically had folks from the biodiesel and ethanol camps in my office this week with, you know, some uncertainty, especially tied into everything else we've talked about, the farm economy, but that very point was made. I think the underlying movement that the world is taking, I formed the Climate Caucus as a freshman. That was unusual, but no one else was willing to do it. I got six other Republicans to come along, and that's been a really active caucus. Most of them are just for show. All the leaders in business, from electric generation, transportation, steel, cement, the big industrial emitters, and farmers. It's only 10% of CO2 emissions in our country from the farm economy, 25% across the world. That's why we got a lot that we can teach the rest of the world of how to lower CO2. But when it comes to where we're going, everybody is buying into that. Little uncertain on the modeling, little uncertain on what else might happen, but ethanol and biodiesel has got a big future because it was actually on the leading edge. I think it weans itself even from a lot of involvement with government over time, because I believe offset markets, I believe people trying to offset their own CO2 footprint, start putting more into biofuels across the board. So I feel good about it.
How do you feel about the Biden administration's trade efforts, and especially now two of the players, Canada and Mexico, not willing to live up to the agreements that they made under USMCA? Corn for Mexico, dairy for Canada.
You know, I think that's sad when you put that much effort into an agreement. I'm not sure if it'd be a different administration in there, whether you would have had more adherence to it, because there might have been more repercussions had you not adhered to what you said you were going to do. I think that's a weakness kind of reflection of the Biden administration, generally speaking. But we'll have to deal with it. I mean, Mexico especially on, you know, GMO corn and some of the things they've said they're going to do. And they look like they're, you know, maybe doubling down on moving in that direction. And when you say you're going to do something, I'd expect with Canada, it's probably less of a economic reason in terms of their economy in general, kind of backpedaling. That's not good. I think that goes along with how we have let the EU take advantage of us on paying the bills on the Ukrainian saga and across the world in terms of defending the world, policing it. And here, even in our own backyard, when it comes to our two biggest trading partners, letting them backpedal, hopefully that's going to reverse its course. And I don't know that they'll call their bluffs, but they certainly are not, you know, they're pushing the envelope. Let's put it that way.
Senator, you have lent support to the Safe Food Act that would give greater authorization for APHIS and for FAS to protect U.S. exports. Would you like to expand on that?
Well, I think that when it comes to, let's look at our poultry industry, for instance. That is one that we do the best job in terms of feed conversion, big export market there. This is simply to not get generalized when we do have an issue here to where it's going to impact, it kind of regionalizes it. It takes any issues that we have here to where we don't get arbitrary, you can't ship into our markets. That's what it is trying to address. I'm hoping that will pass the finish line because it does make sense and it addresses some issues that have cropped up along those lines. So I'm optimistic that that'll get enough support on both sides of the aisle.
Senator, we appreciate your hard work and your limited time in Washington, the success that you've made for rural America and certainly for agriculture, your stance to support farmers and advance your work that will come as a part of the Farm Bill. Thanks for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. You've been here before, and today, Senator, you know you've got the last word.
Well, it's always good having that conversation. I did not grow up on a farm, but I've lived on one ever since. Started a turkey business back in the late 70s and sold that to my partner's kids and grandkids in 2012. And I've been a tree farmer for a long time and have a farming entity with another fellow down in the neighboring county. So I know the farm economy. It's the one place that gets more and more productive every year. We do more with less. I wish we could say that about other sectors of our economy. And when I do get into these discussions, I generally have lived through it. Don't need my young staffers to tell me what it's about. So I always enjoy talking about farm issues.
Our thanks to Indiana U.S. Senator Mike Braun, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Daly.